Segue, to continue at once with the next musical selection or composition.
Segue, to make a transition directly from one section or theme
Segue,
to another.
To move smoothly and unhesitatingly from one state, situation, condition, or element to another.
Segue, to perform in the manner of the preceding section.
Segue, to make a transition from one thing to another smoothly and without interruption.
This is Segue with Dean Aldemaro Romero, a weekly program exploring the lives and work of the people of the College of Arts and Sciences at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
Hello, everybody. Dr. Isaac Blankson was born in Sekondi on the western coast of Ghana in Africa. He obtained his bachelor's degree in geography at the University of Ghana, a master's in development studies at the University of Oslo in Norway, a master's in international affairs at Ohio State, and a doctorate in communication also from Ohio University. Today, he is the chair and associate professor in the Department of Speech Communications at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Welcome to Segue, Dr. Blankson.
Thank you.
I would like for you to start explaining how you became interested in your current profession, given that I know it is a story that our audience would like to hear.
Okay, well, like you pointed out, I started in Ghana and ended up in Norway, and now I'm in the United States. Now, my interest in my current profession, which is teaching, stems from my family also. You know, part of my family is in teaching. But primarily, I really did not start with teaching in mind. I wanted to become a consultant, open up my own research consulting business, until one of my children decided that he wasn't going to travel back to Ghana with me after I got my doctorate. So then I said, okay, what's the alternative? You know, what's the next thing? And so I started looking for applications, and teaching became something attractive that I wanted to do. And so that's how I got involved in teaching and research in the area of international public relations, mm-hmm. in the area of media studies and, mm-hmm. and critical cultural studies as well.
Okay, now when people hear the term public relations, mm-hmm. The first image that comes to people's minds is, oh, okay, these are professionals who basically try to make up their client's image to make them look good. Yeah. Is that a fair definition of public relations?
No, not at all. and there's a simple reason. In the past, probably about 20, 30, 40 years ago, that was the image of public relations. We were known as the spin doctors. You know, we would take whatever it is, negative, and spin it around. Not anymore. People are smarter. Organizations are smarter. The public is smarter. And so our profession has evolved into become more credible, and at the same time, trustworthy. And so when you look at public relations right now, the definition that we go with is building mutually beneficial relationships. So in that case, there's no room for, you know, scamming you or me or spinning anything. The focus now is on the public or the audience or the target population that I'm relating with. How best can I sync their values with the values of the organization? And so you see, over time, we have evolved. Yes, it's true. We used to be called the spin doctors. We got a bad rap for that, but not anymore. And the profession is really cleaned up, and now it's a very professional field to get into.
Now, you said that the way you practice this profession has changed in the last couple of decades
yeah.
or so. What made that change happening? It was just that public became more savvy about what these spin stories were coming through,
yeah.
is because institutions, whether they are corporations or public institutions, became more aware that they needed to be more proactive. What happened that made that change that image?
Right. I think two things here. We have to look at it from internally in the profession itself, and then the external factors. Now, internally, at some point, I think public relations, you know, evolved, and the professionals, the practitioners, and the scholars, academicians realized that, wait, if we want our organizations to really function effectively in the communities that they are operating, then we cannot always side or be on the side of the organizations. We have to also be on the side and be advocates for the clients as well. Is that the community or the public? And so that issue became very critical internally. So there was a debate about that. And so it be also, of course, internally, we were being described as the least credible profession, one of the professions on this planet. And nobody wants to be tagged that. And so it forced us to also review or do internal assessment of who we truly are and what the profession wants to be known as. Mm-hmm. And so those were the internal forces that led us to really take a look at ourselves and figure out, okay, how best can we represent these two organizations and the client being the public? And the best way is to really respect the public, respect the community, and therefore help our organization to see that they also have to respect the public and the community that they do business with. Yeah. So internally, that was the force behind it. Of course, externally, there are a lot of other factors. You know, media plays part of it. You know, if you're always being talked, you know, media is always picking up on you as a profession and say, well, you are the spin doctors and you're always taking what is bad and making it look good even though it's bad. Over time, it gets to you. So not only that, also the role of the public itself is very important. We, you know, in those days where most of the communication was just one way form of communication, that's part of the issue. We would just tell you. Now the public has access to all sorts of information. And it's a two-way thing now. It's even, I would say, it's more than two-way. Mm-hmm. You know, now social media is there, all those kind of stuff. So the concept of truth or who has the information is now so divulged that everybody has their own form of truth.
Okay.
And therefore, the public is also more educated and more, you know, informed.
Now, you just described these changes that were kind of more cultural than mm-hmm. anything else. But in the last few years, we have been living into an environment where there are two things, particularly in this country, that seems to be affecting everything. One is the financial situation.
Right.
Which probably make a lot of institutions less prone to spend money mm-hmm. in public relations.
Right.
But also the political climate in which there is this tremendous polarization. Mm-hmm. And basically with a lot of media that only report news the way you want to listen to or to watch on TV. To what extent those two factors, the financial one and the political one, have affected the practice of public relations?
Right. And that's a good question. There was a time where if companies were downsizing, for example, one of the first departments to go would be their public relations department. And there was a simple reason for that, and that is that they did not understand the value of public relations. You know, organizations and business, of course, financially, you have to show them how much financial contribution you make to the organization for them to value you and keep you. And unfortunately, in our profession, because we are in the relationship building function, we cannot quantify that. You know, friendship, you cannot put a value on friendship. So that was the concept. So it took a while for the practice of the profession of public relations to actually educate our own management and say, look, if you want us to quantify and tell you the dollar value of what we do, you're never going to get that. However, think about it this way. Everything that goes on here, even marketing, depends on the relationship that you build with your customers. Mm-hmm. So we were able to talk to management, upper management, to really understand the value of public relations, not in terms of financial contributions. And we were successful at that. So now, the increase in acceptance of public relations as part of upper management is one of the result of that effort. Mm-hmm. The other part, the second part, is the media thing that you talk about, you know, the public perception and all of that. Now, I think what it is that the public and even the organizations have also grown to understand what contributions PR people do to either even organizations or even to the community. In the sense that, one, for example, we've had situations where organizations have messed up. They cause blunders, they screw up, you know, image is destroyed. So we have to come in and build or restore that image and make, and it all falls on public relations.
And I'm sorry, one example of that will be, for example, all the millions that you see being spent by British Petroleum, BP,
exactly,
with what happened in the Gulf of Mexico.
Exactly, you know, and that's very critical. Because BP's existence now, especially in today's climate, where the public is informed or have access to a variety of information, mm-hmm, it's very important for BP, for example, to focus on the PR aspect. And so now every organization has a value in public relations, and it's actually one of the fastest growing professions in this society.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, would you say that these days, 2013, the internet is the most important vehicle for the public relations practitioners?
You know what? I teach a class on that, you know, the web, internet, social media, and PR. And my answer will be yes and no. Now, yes, because the internet actually has revolutionized the way we all practice our profession, including public relations. So take, for example, access to all these social media things. Now, an event happens right now, everybody around you is sending out pictures through Instagram. People are going Facebook, you know, every organization is on Facebook. So the question now is, what role does public relations play? And so we have to take all these technologies, including the internet especially, and say, okay, how can that enhance our profession and build our relationship with our clients? It's made it easier for us. It speed up the process where we contact our public or clients. You know, we can just send things instantly. We can have chat. We can even simulate crisis, you know, communication issues on there. So the internet really is helping our profession. Now, the flip side of it, the scary part, is we don't have control over anything anymore. You know, and so, but if you don't have control of anything, especially in your profession, then how do you function? No. You know, so a 10-year-old boy who knows a little bit about computers can create havoc,
yeah,
on behind an internet, yeah, to, for a company.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Now, we have been talking about changes through time, mm-hmm, due to financial, political, cultural aspects. Can you tell the audience what things have not changed in the basics of public relations in the last few decades?
I think I think part of it is the basic underlying element of practicing public relations having changed. And what it means is that we still relate to people. We, regardless of technology and all of that, we still need that face-to-face human connection to be effective. Yes, we can, you know, sit behind internet and computers and all of that. Still, that human element. And I don't think we're ever going to go away from that. Because, believe it, I mean, we all have to see each other at some point and smile and dine and wine and all of that. Mm-hmm. That's still very critical. That's one thing that I always tell my students. That, yes, you have all these sophisticated gadgets and tools, you know, for your function. But do not ever forget the value, the importance of the human being that you are shaking hands with.
Yeah.
So if you have to make that effort to go and visit that individual and shake hands, go ahead and do it. And I don't think that's going to change.
One of the skills more sought after by employers these, mm-hmm, days, regardless if you are a chemist, an architect, mm-hmm, an engineer, doesn't matter, are communication skills. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, since you teach in that area, how well how good of a job are colleges and universities doing in providing, in training students with that skill so they can be successful in life regardless of their profession?
Right. We have to look at it from multiple perspectives. And one is that you have to look at the oral communication, the verbal part of it, and the written part. Now, when it comes to oral communication, which we will call public speaking, research tells us that a lot of people are actually scared, scared of public speaking than dying.
Yeah, yeah, I see those statistics,
right.
Yeah.
And what that tells us is that we have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether we're doing a good job at that, it's still difficult to tell. Because in our institution, for example, 105, which is the public speaking class, is required. You know, well, nowadays required. And so every freshman has to take 105 as part of their general education requirements. My instructors, my teachers tell me over time, those who have taken those classes and the advanced public speaking classes do better in other classes when it has to do with presentations.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually had students who go for interviews, and the interviewer, the employer, will call me and say, we were very impressed with the oral skills, you know, the speaking skills of your student. And then we say, because they've taken these classes. So, yes, it is a very important skill to have. However, the written part is the challenging, especially, you know, being exposed to a lot of these students. For whatever reason, their writing communication skill is still challenging.
You think it's because they don't read enough?
I think partly it's the whole educational system from, you know, starting up to getting to college doesn't emphasize that.
Okay.
And you know, I've talked to some of the students, you know, why is it that, you know, it's sometimes amazing that you can get a student in college who cannot put sentences together. Mm-hmm. And the question in my mind is, how did you get here? How did you pass through all of this from middle school to high school and all that to college without you being able to write?
And to be frank with you, I think internet may have made things even worse because students feel they don't need to use punctuation or capitalization or make too much sense in grammar and use all these LOL things. And that becomes really, it's not English anymore.
No. And that shows up even in their exams and papers that they write.
Uh-huh.
I've seen students put together sentences with no punctuation, no nothing. I mean, nothing. Sometimes they don't even start a sentence with a capital letter. And you're like, wait.
You are not sending a text message.
But it's, you know, it's a situation that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
But I don't know at what level we address that.
Because
I think it has to be addressed right at the roots before they even get to a certain point where it doesn't. You know, they look at you like, what the heck, I've done this all my life. What are you telling me?
Yeah, but the thing is that is can universities and colleges with the fewer and fewer resources that we have can also take now or need to take a remediation role for this type of thing. So that's
a good question.
That's a good question.
Know,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the public speaking aspects of it, when you mentioned correctly that the number one thing that people fear the most is to speak in public, not to die, because unless you're in a hospital bed, you're not going to die. From watching people standing up and talking to audiences, what do you think are the major mistakes that most people make when speaking in public?
I think one is they don't prepare. Personally, I have seen, because the idea is if you prepare well, you become confident. Everybody who goes into a public speaking situation has stage fright. Those who are able to get away from it quickly are the ones who are confident and say, you know what, I think I've prepared enough, I can do this. But if you have not prepared, that's where your mind tries to play those tricks on you. What if I forget? And so people who don't prepare also try to memorize. And I always tell my students, never memorize your stuff. Just know what you're going to talk about. Because if it comes freely, that's where it becomes conversational. And the audience tends to like it because you are relating to them and giving them examples and all from your own personal life. And so to me, I think the first and primary thing is preparation. Because everything else follows. Everything else follows from your lack of preparation.
Now, obviously, not everybody has to speak in public every day, but something we do every day is interpersonal communication. Mm-hmm. What are the major mistakes that we make as persons when it comes to talking to each other?
I think, and I'm glad you like that question, because communication is not only about, you know, speaking. It's about relating to others, which is the interpersonal, you know, part. And the challenge is, you know, we call it communication apprehension, why are you not relating to me? Why are you not reaching out to me? And coming from Ghana, it's slightly different from when you come here, because in Ghana it's a collectivist society where you're actually supposed to relate to everybody in the mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. So I am used to that. But then you come here and people are very individualistic, in the sense that your neighbor doesn't even know who you are. And so that is where the interpersonal relationship begin to fall apart in this, you know, at least based on my experience. However, this is the challenge. I think the main challenge here is everybody is waiting for the other to make the first move. Mm-hmm. And that skepticism of, okay, I'm waiting for you to say hi before I say hi. I'm waiting for you to stretch your hand and before I shake you, becomes the barrier. And so what I've seen is that whenever somebody extends their hands, guess what? We also extend back and say, oh, hi. And then all of a sudden we begin into a conversation and begin to build relationships. Yeah. And I think in this country, especially here, the issue of trust, I don't know you enough, so I can't trust you. So why would I share? Why would I relate to you on a level?
Yeah.
It also stands in the way, you know. You and I probably know that. You know, I mean, when we go back home, we share a lot of stuff with people that we just met, because it's a communal thing. We look after each other.
And not only that, when you, in terms of the interpersonal space is much more small in other cultures mm-hmm. than it is in Anglo-Saxon cultures. And you live in Norway, and I understand in Scandinavia it's even worse. Even worse. People are much.
The space is huge.
Yeah, I heard once a documentary on Finland that a couple said that they only said to each other, "I love you," once in their entire lifetime.
Yeah.
It's like the big thing to say, "I love you" once.
Right. And that's the, you know, people in those societies do not want you to violate mm-hmm. their space mm-hmm. unless you are specifically invited into that mm-hmm. space. And that explains it. So if you are quiet sitting there, I don't have any right to come and ask you, "Oh, why are you quiet? And, you know, what can I do?" Unless you invite me into that space.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very common here. I was even telling students yesterday that it's an insult back home in Ghana. If I have to visit you as a friend or family member, to call you and ask permission to visit you, or to call you and say, "Hey, can I come over?" It's a big insult. I just show up.
Mm-hmm.
But here, I have to call and say, "No, Dean Romero, are you free? Are you available? Can I come over and have something?" And then you say, "Okay," and before I come, I cannot just show up.
Yeah.
You know. And so, yeah, the issue of space is really important.
Now, I once heard that the root of virtually all human problems is communications. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that, and I think there is some element of credibility or truth to that. And I think part of it is that the root of all our problems is communication, in the sense that you have to look at it from understanding each other, the use of language in itself,
and not only verbal language, but also even body language,
non-verbal language. And those, especially the non-verbal language, causes a lot of misinterpretations, a lot of disinformation, and a lot of confusion and conflict. Look at it this way. The reason why we haven't been able to solve a lot of global problems is because we communicate about those problems differently. Yeah. Our definition of the problem is different. Our solutions to the problem is different. And we can't even seem to agree on what the definitions are.
Yeah.
So if you put the two of us together, our communication becomes a fight,
mm-hmm.
just like we see with the Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah. Now, I was thinking that we mentioned earlier BP and the oil spill in the Gulf Coast. But also recently we have the case of the tsunami that hit Japan and created this problem with the nuclear plants.
Right.
And there was a lot of criticism mm-hmm. of how the Japanese government and the Japanese industry handled that because they were minimizing mm-hmm. the effects. But some people pointed out that Japanese are very deferential people. They don't look for that kind of confrontation.
Right.
And by nature, they try to minimize what could be a very negative message. Right. Yeah. To what extent culture is so important to understand the way people communicate?
And that's really, you know, interesting question, because I just published with two of my colleagues an article on the same subject, you know, looking at the Japan crisis, you know, and how they responded, the cultural difference and public relations responses. So it just came out this past year. And it is very true that before we make judgments on whether they responded effectively or not, we have to look at their culture and what their culture dictates or governs in terms of behavior. And that is what, unfortunately, those who are making those judgments and assessments from different countries forget to see. Now, does that justify the approach? I don't know, but I would think before I throw stones at you, I need to understand where you're coming from. And so if you look at the Japanese culture, for example, people are saying, well, they have to be, you know, forthright and apologize and all that kind of stuff. In Japanese culture, it's very important for the CEOs to not be arrogant and say, well, we have everything under control, we're going to fix it. They have to have a submissive approach towards the thing. And so therefore, if you look at the way they responded, they were apologizing more and saying less to the public, right? So that's one. Now, the Western society is saying, wait, we don't need you to sit down and be apologizing. We just need to tell us how you're solving the problem. Now, you also have to understand, in Japanese culture, authority figure is different. So if you are in that hierarchy, you're expected to behave certain ways, and people do not challenge you. So the people of the Japanese people will not challenge their leaders when it comes to that, because they are the authority figures. And therefore, whatever they're telling them should be the truth. And therefore, they have to believe what they're saying. And then we have Western media, which is impatient and saying, well, we need all the facts and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, so those cultural nuances become a problem, especially when in crises that are big and usually have global impact.
Okay. Well, in the 30 seconds that we have left, very quickly, summarize what is the way the students respond to what they learn in your classes and that of your colleagues.
In 30 seconds. One, I think I personally give them something that it's different that they already know or are exposed to, which means I take them mostly beyond the confines of the United States. So I give them a lot of examples that are global, and you know, it's great that I've traveled a lot, so I can bring a lot of these you know, global perspectives to what I teach.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Dr. Isaac Blanson of the Department of Speech Communication at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, on this interesting conversation on personal communication, should we say. And next week, we're going to have Dr. Masango Shibandi of the Department of Chemistry, who will be talking about the chemistry of batteries. Oh. So stay tuned.
This has been Segway with Dean Aldemaro Romero, a production of the Department of Mass Communications at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. All rights reserved, 2013.